Hi, this is Dr. Pedro Ramirez, Editor-in-Chief of the International Journal of Gynecological Cancer. And today I have the great pleasure of having on the podcast Amy Jamieson and Jessica McAlpine from the Department of Gynecology and Obstetrics in the Division of Gynecologic Oncology at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. The title of this podcast is Recurrence Rates and Patterns of Recurrence in Stage 1A P53 Abnormal Endometrial Cancer with and without myometrial invasion. Amy, Jess, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Well, very, very exciting opportunity for us, obviously, to talk about this very important topic. And again, congratulations to all of you for completing this this study. And there's a number of questions, obviously, that we want to talk about, not only the topic, but also diving in a little bit into the results of the study. So I wanted to start with Amy, and I was wondering if you can start by discussing what percentage of uterine tumors are P53 abnormal, and why are they an important element in terms of really predicting outcomes?
Yeah, so the studies show that P53 abnormal endometrial cancers make up about 15% of all endometrial cancers, and P53 abnormal endometrial cancers have consistently been shown to have the worst clinical outcomes of the four molecular subtypes. We know they have high recurrence rates, even in patients with stage one disease, and this is regardless of the histotype and tumor grade. And the data also shows that although it only makes up about 15% of all endometrial cancers, the subtype is responsible for majority, so 50 to 70% of all endometrial cancer mortality. And it's also important to identify P53 abnormal tumors, as recent data has shown improved survival outcomes in patients with P53 abnormal endometrial cancer when adjuvant chemotherapy is used in addition to radiation. And this is why the 2020 ESGO-ESDRO ESP and the 2022 ESMO endometrial cancer guidelines both recommend that patients with P53 abnormal endometrial cancer that have myometrial invasion be considered as high risk and treated with both chemotherapy plus or minus radiation, regardless of the stage, grade, and histotype.
Great. Thank you for that excellent introduction, obviously, into the topic. And we'll go to Jess for this next question as to what was the rationale for this particular study and why did you think it was an important study in evaluating these patients, P53 abnormal with no myoinvasion?
Yeah, thank you. I think we're motivated by our own clinical experience with these patients. We were surprised by what seemed like high recurrence rates and also seeing this huge variation in how patients were managed within and across centers that we've both worked in. We appreciate that also there's this crazy range of presentations, right? Is a 5-centimeter serous cancer within the endometrium, is that risk really that different than someone with 1 millimeter of myometrial invasion, or is it not maybe quite different from someone with just a polyp? You could have all of these different presentations. And, you know, I think also we felt like maybe we were the group that had an opportunity to examine this question properly because we've got a huge cohort of patients that had been molecularly defined and with good clinical pathologic and outcome data.
Yeah. No, and I think obviously, as you pointed out, really very important now that we have the molecular classification. Because up until now, really, patients with no myometrial invasion were really, as you mentioned, considered somewhat of a low risk. So I think this is really important and timely. Now, I'll talk about, you know, regarding the design. What was the specifics on the study design for this study? And wondering if you can tell us a little bit about the inclusion and exclusion criteria.
No, sure. So we'd previously performed this molecular classification retrospectively on a number of cohorts. We had some from our own series. We had a big pan-Canadian cohort, and we had an international sort of population-based cohort. And with this, we had treatment data and outcome data where we were able to look and included stage 1A cases, provided we had their molecular subtype and, you know, treatment and outcome specifics. Remember, these patients then, of course, weren't part of a trial, so they were treated in a variety of ways, whatever the standard of care was at that time. And I think that variation we saw in practice reflects the fact that physicians are uncertain or there's a lack of clear consensus of how to treat these patients. I'll comment that we were initially more encompassing. We actually included all 1As without myometrial invasion, for example, of all purported high-risk histotypes, like looking at clear cell and otherwise, but ended up pulling out the POLE. For example, we had a clear cell POLE and 4 mismatch repair deficient tumors and 7 clear cell or mixed NSMP tumors, just to make it a cleaner story within P53 abnormals. And again, the outcomes were quite different within that. We wanted it to be a tighter story.
Great. Now, I'll turn back to Amy. And what were the results of the study? And what are some of the things that you really want to highlight as some of the take-home messages?
Yeah, so in the end, we ended up with a cohort of 65 patients that had stage 1A P53 abnormal endometrial cancer with no myometrial invasion. And this included 22 patients who had polyp-confined disease, 38 who had residual endometrial disease, 2 who had no residual tumor in the hysterectomy specimen. And in 3 cases, it was not possible to determine whether the tumor was confined to a polyp or not. In the second cohort were 97 patients who had stage 1A with myoinvasion, less than 50%. And what we found was that there was no difference in the rates of disease recurrence in patients with stage 1A P53 abnormal endometrial cancer with no myometrial invasion, where the recurrence rate was 16% in this total group, compared to the patients with stage 1A with myometrial invasion, where the recurrence rate was 17%. We also found there was no difference in both disease-specific survival and overall survival for the stage 1A patients with no myometrial invasion compared to patients with myometrial invasion. And we were also interested to see if the rates of recurrence differed in the no myometrial invasion group based on whether the tumor was polyp confined versus whether there was residual endometrial disease. And we did find that the risk of recurrence was lower in patients with stage 1A no myometrial invasion if they had disease confined to a polyp, where only 10% recurred, compared to stage 1A and no myometrial invasion when there was residual endometrial disease, where 19% of patients recurred. But this difference was not statistically significant, likely because we're getting into smaller numbers. And finally, we were also interested in the site of disease recurrence for these patients with stage 1A disease with no myometrial invasion. And we actually found that most recurrences, so 89% of the recurrences, were distant recurrence. There were no isolated vaginal vault recurrences in this cohort, and there was only 1 pelvic recurrence. And in these patients that did have a distant recurrence, all but 1 had actually died at the time of the data collection, so with an average time to death from recurrence of only 1.9 years. So just really highlighting that these patients had, you know, very poor outcomes.
Excellent. Outstanding. So lots of important information. And we're going to get into some of the specifics pertaining to the results. And some of these questions come from our own fellows here now in the journal. And I'll turn to Jess for this next question from Beatriz Navarro from the Canary Islands. And she asked, did you analyze the molecular classification at the time of endometrial biopsy or after hysterectomy?
Yeah, so thank you. For the majority, 85% or more, these were performed on hysterectomy specimens, mostly because that's what was available to us in this retrospective analysis in either banked specimens or archival specimens. But of course, endometrial biopsies or curettings are fantastic specimens to perform molecular classification on, and actually the preferred choice in clinical practice or prospective series, as you have this tremendous antigen preservation, right? As your biopsy or curettings are immediately put into formalin, so well-preserved compared to the lag time of hysterectomy. You have huge tumor volume in these biopsy specimens, and it's really easy to do DNA extraction on.
Very well. Now, this next question from Elena Olearo from Italy. I'll turn to Amy. And she asked, did you find any correlation between lymphovascular space invasion and distant recurrence, particularly nodal recurrence?
Yeah, so, you know, we did not look at this actually because the rates of lymphovascular invasion were so low in the patients with stage 1A, no myometrial invasion. There was actually only one case that had LVI in that cohort. Therefore, you know, the numbers were too small to look at this separately. And this is not surprising that the numbers were low, as, you know, lymphovascular invasion is usually only seen when there is myometrial invasion. But we did actually check this with one of our pathologists, and although it's uncommon, you can get lymphovascular invasion in P53 abnormal carcinomas that do not invade the myometrium, just like you can have a P53 abnormal endometrial carcinoma that is confined to a polyp, but they'll have tumor in the omentum at the same time, just highlighting that these are aggressive cancers that behave different. And I do think it's also important to note that in the tumors that did have myometrial invasion, 25% of them had lymphovascular invasion. Again, just highlighting that these P53 abnormal endometrial cancers are aggressive tumors. You know, we know that they do have high rates of LVI, and previous data has shown they have a high rate of lymph node metastases. And, you know, that is a common finding in this subtype.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you for obviously looking into that further and providing this information. Now, Jess, I think, you know, the one of the relevant questions is regarding adjuvant treatment. So the question actually from several of our fellows was pertaining to whether there was a sub-analysis comparing only the patients with myometrial invasion who did not receive adjuvant therapy to the patients with no myometrial invasion.
Yeah, these are great questions. I'm going to try to take a minute to answer this because there's a couple ways you can look at this. So first off, yes, there's challenges when you try to break cohorts down, obviously, into subsets or perform sub-analyses, as of course the numbers get smaller and smaller and you lose power to detect a meaningful difference. But let's break the numbers down. So more patients who had myometrial invasion were treated. So only 30% of the cohort with myometrial invasion had surgery alone, no adjuvant treatment, compared with over 70% of the cohort without myometrial invasion. And yes, half or 50% of the cohort with myometrial invasion had chemotherapy with or without radiation, as compared to only 20% of the cohort without myometrial invasion. And recurrence rates were higher in untreated patients in both cohorts. But did receiving chemotherapy, did that in those, for example, with myometrial invasion, did that nudge those survival parameters up or improve things? Yes, we suspect so. And current guidelines actually would have directed even more of those patients to treatment now. Would chemotherapy have maybe nudged up and improved the outcomes in those without myometrial invasion or treatment? We hope so. So it's, to me, less about seeing a difference. We hope if more people got treated, there would be a separation in the curves of 1A with and without myometrial invasion. But the bigger point is we want to improve outcomes for both groups by treating them and not missing that opportunity. To me, the 19% recurrence rates, particularly in those with residual endometrial disease, is unacceptably high. And those distant recurrences that Amy talked about are sort of leave me asking if we could have improved their outcomes with upfront systemic or combined adjuvant treatment.
Yeah, excellent point. This question comes from Sabrina Piedimonti from Montreal. And Amy, she asks, for higher risk subgroups such as P53, some centers may favor chemotherapy to address the higher risk of distant recurrences with vaginal brachytherapy to minimize the pelvic side effects, especially when disease is confined to a polyp. However, from your study, it seems like none of the patients received this regimen. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, there were some patients actually in this cohort who did receive chemotherapy plus Volt brachytherapy. They were included in the chemotherapy plus or minus radiation group in tables 1 and 2 in the paper. So the radiation included either Volt brachytherapy or external beam. So there were a few cases that had this treatment. But I guess just important to highlight these patients were not part of a clinical trial, and how they were treated did vary quite markedly. Again, just highlighting, I think, the individual physician uncertainty and the lack of a clear consensus on, you know, how to best manage these patients.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, obviously we all know from tumor boards and when these patients come up, there's often a lot of discussion as to how do we manage these patients. This next question for Jessa is from Ilaria Capasso in Italy. And she asks, most recurrences in patients with stage 1A without myometrial invasion were distant, with no isolated vaginal vault recurrences, and all but one distant recurrence occurred in patients who had not received adjuvant chemotherapy. Since only 2% of p53 abnormal patients without myometrial invasion had substantial LVSI in this population, can you please hypothesize why so many distant recurrences occur in this group with no myometrial invasion and negative LVSI?
Yes, thanks, Ilaria, for bringing us back to that point about distant recurrences that arose in patients without chemo, and again in these patients without sort of obvious reasons with myometrial invasion or otherwise. So how do these recurrences happen? We know from serous endometrial cancer data in the era before molecular classification came that patients with even polyp-confined disease can present with distant metastases. Dr. Jameson raised that too. And even that precursor lesion, right? That endometrial intraepithelial carcinoma, really just a p53 mutated monolayer of highly atypical cells in the endometrium. They also have been found to be in association with extrauterine disease. So maybe there's transperitoneal spread, more like a high-grade serous ovarian cancer than via lymphatics. I would say to also remember that lymphvascular space invasion, it's a complex thing that really depends. Its significance, I would argue, depends on the molecular subtype. You have poorly mutated tumors that have substantial LVI, and the overall behavior is just of an excellent outcome poorly mutated tumor. You have NSMP tumors where maybe LVI matters a bit, but it's outweighed by more critical features like estrogen receptor status. I would argue with p53 abnormal cancers, these are bad actors. Their flavor is bad. They're more likely to have lymphvascular space invasion, yes, more likely to be node positive or extrauterine disease. But is your decision to, or your tipping point to treat or not treat based on LVI? Or should it be the overall picture? Like, this is a patient with a p53 abnormal cancer, and I need to consider adjuvant treatment.
Yeah, definitely. So obviously weighing in which of these is a higher risk factor. Back to Sabrina Biademonte from Montreal. Amy, she asks, do you think that the fact that there were no local recurrences, but rather distant recurrences, that this could lead to a proposal for de-escalation of radiotherapy, favoring chemotherapy only in cases of no myometrial invasion?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting question, but you know, unfortunately, I don't think we can answer it from the results of this study. Last year, we did publish a paper looking at the outcomes according to adjuvant treatment received within the four molecular subtypes in a large cohort of 2,500 endometrial cancers. And we did find within the p53 abnormal endometrial cancers that patients that had combined chemoradiation had significantly better survival outcomes compared to patients who just had radiation alone or chemotherapy alone, suggesting that radiation may actually improve outcomes when it's used in addition to chemotherapy in this subtype. But yeah, so I think it's an interesting question, but I think it for now it remains unanswered.
Yeah, and to that point, again, another question from Ilaria Capasso asking about future studies. She asked, in the group of stage 1A without myometrial invasion, survival curves show similar prognostic outcomes regardless of chemotherapy administration. However, there's also show a trend towards worse outcomes for those who did not receive chemotherapy. This is likely due to small numbers and small population. Due to the rarity of p53 abnormal disease confined to the endometrium, it's challenging to have significant results in this subset of patients. How would you design a future study to confirm your results?
Yeah, this is an important point to raise. And as we've discussed, this data is retrospective. And unfortunately, we have very little data on this rare subset of patients with stage 1A p53 abnormal endometrial cancer without myometrial invasion, as these patients have actually previously been excluded from clinical trials. So there's really little data out there. And obviously, the best way to answer this question would be to do a randomized controlled trial where patients with stage 1A p53 abnormal endometrial cancer without myometrial invasion, a randomized to no adjuvant therapy versus adjuvant therapy, and whether that was chemo plus Volt Brachy or chemo plus external beam. But, you know, that would be the cleanest way to answer this. But, you know, I think this would obviously be a difficult study to do, given it's a very rare subset. I think it'd be hard to get enough numbers for adequate power. And I also think you may find that many clinicians might not feel comfortable enrolling patients on a trial like this as well, knowing that the patient could end up with no adjuvant therapy. You know, we know in many centres these patients are actually currently being treated with adjuvant therapy. So I think you might struggle to get clinician buy-in for a trial designed like that. But it is an important point.
Yeah, very interesting in terms of your point regarding likelihood of patient accrual based on randomization. So next question comes from Elena Olearo, and I'll turn to Jess about serous histotypes. And she asked, serous histotype appears to be more frequent in the study cohort, and P53 abnormal is one of the main molecular features of serous endometrial carcinoma. Do you think that your findings, including distant site metastases, support the idea that we must consider this specific pattern of disease more likely, similar to epithelial ovarian cancer, and offer adjuvant chemotherapy even to those cases with no myometrial invasion?
Great and interesting question. First, Elena, to your point, yes, serous carcinomas are the most common histotype within P53 abnormal endometrial cancers, and there's multiple publications demonstrating a higher likelihood of nodal spread and or other metastatic sites in this subset. And yes, the TCGA showed both histopathologic similarities and molecular similarities between what was called serous-like copy number high, now P53 abnormal surrogate endometrial cancers, and high-grade serous ovarian cancers. And we have another paper that's just out that uses shallow whole genome sequencing to characterize a large cohort of P53 abnormal endometrial cancers and able to identify these subsets with features that we also often see in serous ovarian cancers, like cyclin E amplification or homologous recombination deficiency. So these comparisons and tying in a need for systemic treatment are relevant. I guess what we don't know is if the response to treatments that are used for serous ovarian cancer beyond chemotherapy maybe will be the same. And I think that we suspect they're not going to be exactly the same, but they will still add value. And there's some really interesting clinical trials that are now opening that will look at adjuvant treatment, yes, chemotherapy, but also targeted treatments specifically within P53 abnormal endometrial cancers to answer that. But it's a great point and a great analogy and just needs to be studied more in this disease site.
Great. Excellent. So I want to be respectful of your time, and I just have two more questions. I'll turn to Amy first. Amy, obviously an important study, very interesting information that we learned from this study. But what would you say about the weaknesses of the study?
Yeah, so one weakness is that not all patients had full surgical staging. So therefore, there could be some occult stage 3 cases that were included, because we know there is a higher rate of node positive disease in this molecular subtype. But in the cohort of stage 1A with no myometrial invasion in this study, 86% of the patients did have pelvic node assessment, and that was either a full lymph node dissection or sentinel node biopsy, depending on the center. And 85% of them had either an omental biopsy or a full omentectomy. So most were fully staged, but not all. And, you know, another weakness that we've already discussed is that this is a retrospective cohort. You know, therefore, we're unable to determine how or why adjuvant treatment decisions were made, you know, or what variables might have been used to influence those treatment decisions. And remembering that the molecular data was unknown at the time these treatment decisions were made.
Excellent. So I'll end with a question that we often ask the authors of the studies. And I'll start with Jess, and certainly, obviously, love to hear from Amy as well. How do the results of the study have modified or impacted your practice, or how you counsel your patients based on the information you learned from this study?
Yeah, I know. Okay. So it's tough, right? We've all seen in our own center, some will treat, some don't. Those who don't treat currently will cite current guidelines where they're less prescriptive about, or they certainly don't mandate chemotherapy. But as we talked about, it's going to be hard to get the level of evidence to change those guidelines. For what we're doing, we're presenting it with our multidisciplinary tumor group at a retreat next month. Right now, it's a case-by-case basis and discussions. I guess I would add that I find patients are increasingly savvy about their own molecular subtype and where there's a lack of consensus in treatment, and I would welcome or let people consider bringing patients into that discussion where we have some gray areas in our treatment.
Excellent. And Amy, any additional comments?
Yeah, no, I just think it is still a case by case, but these, they're not easy decisions. So I think reviewing these cases at tumor boards, they don't come up often. So I think it warrants a group discussion and yeah, and being open with the patient. But I do think they have the right to know that the recurrence rate, is at a level where we would normally recommend adjuvant therapy, and having that discussion with them is as important. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. And Jess, thank you actually for bringing that point as we are actually preparing for our annual GYN oncology retreat in our department. I'm actually now going to add this specific group and this specific question to our retreat as well. So thank you for that. I want to thank you both, of course, obviously, for accepting our invitation to the podcast, for sending the article to our journal, and really for the time that you spent in answering these questions. Really learned a lot. Thank you again for contributing this to our literature and for all of the contributions that you have made to gynecologic oncology. So really appreciative of your time. Thank you.
Thanks so much for the opportunity, hey.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Cheers.